smartest man alive!
You're gonna die, clown!
And that's what I call a quality A tool.
I'm Scuba Sam, Scuba Steve's father.
We eat the pig and then together we burn!
Well, I have a microphone and you don't.
So you will listen to every damn word I have to say!
Hello, everyone, and welcome to yet another episode of the Billy Gilmore Podcast. Normally, this is the pod for the discerning Adam Sandler fan, the pod for the fan of the Sandman. Changing things up, we're doing things a little bit differently. We're in uncharted territory. But as always, my name is Wilson Smith.
Hi, this is Chris Giles.
And Austin Culp.
And we are so happy that you are listening to us wherever our fine podcasts are found. As mentioned, or if you listened to the last episode where we covered Grandma's Boy, we have reached the end of the line currently for Mr. Sandler and his films. And we have decided to dive into the, you know, the wild and crazy catalog of other Happy Madison projects, which we will get to. And we did with Grandma's Boy. But we're taking a little trip back in time. We are going back to the origin, going back to the source. It's very exciting to cover this fellow and to talk about some of these movies. There wasn't another really appropriate place on the podcast because Sandler isn't in these films and he doesn't produce them. But tonight we're going to be doing Billy Gilmore Origins, Chris Farley.
Yes.
We're covering the wonderful Chris Farley. And tonight we are going to be covering, we're probably going to do two episodes on Farley, we think. And tonight we are knocking out his two collaborations with fellow Sandler Squad member David Spade. And those are, of course, Tommy Boy and Black Sheep. Very excited about this.
I've been looking forward to this one for a long time. I think even back in like the old days, we've had vague notions of, well, what do we do when we finish Sandler's filmography? And I think even back then it was like, well, we got to do Farley. So it is a pleasure to finally talk about this this great man who left us, well, you know, far too soon.
Absolutely. So we are, like I said, we're going to be talking about his two. I mean, I would say generally, I don't believe there's too much dispute about this, but I mean, I would say fairly obviously his two most like well-known starring vehicles. He didn't have, unfortunately, you know, he died at age 33. He sadly left us before he was able to get too many star vehicles under his belt. But I would say definitely, you know, something like there's a distinction between like Beverly Hills Ninja, which we'll cover in the next episode. I was aware of that movie growing up, but Tommy Boy and Black Sheep were like, you know, like all my friends loved them and talked about them. And like, those were the big ones for sure. Tommy Boy, especially, although Black Sheep got a lot of play. So there's no new Sandler news. You know, we're not, I guess we're like, we, if there are any consequential updates, we'll pop in like during these origin episodes or like the wilder world of Billy Gilmore, Happy Madison. We'll update people if, you know, I don't know, Adam Sandler wins an Oscar or, you know, runs for governor or something. But besides that, we're just going to be, it's going to be more focused. It's going to be us talking about these terrific movies. And Farley, we have discussed him before, obviously just in the context of his friendship with Sandler and their time together on Saturday Night Live. I meant to get his biography, Chris Farley's biography from the library, and it was a physical copy that was being delivered to a new library, to my local location. Haven't been able to read it yet. So instead I downloaded David Spade's autobiography and read through that a little bit, which gave some insight. It's also very interesting and will serve us well when we get to the Spade starring movies, the solos, you Joe Dirts and what have you. But yeah, so Chris Farley, just a little bit of a, like kind of a potted history of like how he, you know, he was, he started off, I mean, like, you know, decided he wanted to do like, I think he was like in his like teens when he decided he wanted to do like improv and like acting. He's got his big start at Second City in Chicago. He actually started at Second City the exact same day as Stephen Colbert, which is interesting. I mean, like all those people who are swimming around, it's like Saturday Night Live, and obviously there's a lot of overlap, but all those people who are swimming around at that time are, you know, I mean, Amy Poehler, like, you know, shows up a little bit later at Second City and, like, you know, had some interactions with Farley. Bob Odenkirk, obviously.
I think you can really think of Farley, I think it's important to, when you think about his life, his age and his career, you know, I certainly think of him as someone who was like a very strong, like second generation SNL person. Like he, you know, kind of, you know, famously and in some ways, sadly, very much, idealized the likes of John Belushi. Farley was born in 1964. So that would make, you know, him a teenager when Belushi is blowing up on SNL and Animal House and Blues Brothers. And, you know, Farley would have been in, you know, his late teens when Belushi died, unfortunately, in very similar circumstances as Farley would pass away years later. And so, as I understand, because, like, I have read The Chris Farley Show, which is a very good oral biography, and, you know, has some great tidbits about his career and life. I definitely recommend it. And that book gets into, he was, I think, a popular, well-liked kid in high school. He was like an athlete and very much of a jock, but also just, you know, had from an early age that very infectious energy and, already had like that addiction of getting laughs and pleasing people. And I think early on he was doing theater stuff and improv and so on. And then, yeah, eventually he, you know, followed the footsteps of many of his SNL idols and did Second City in Chicago. And when you look at some of Farley's big SNL stuff, like some of his iconic bits, like, for example, of course, Matt Foley, the motivational speaker that had its origins in Second City. It was like a bit, I think, primarily created and written by Bob Odenkirk, who was in Second City at the time, and passed it on to Farley. And Farley brought in, you know, some of his very Midwestern, Midwestern sort of tropes and characterizations. And by all accounts, he was already kind of a star of the Second City stage from an early age. It sounds like this guy's star was already on the rise at a very young age.
Shocking to like actually see how much of that Belushi lineup is like the same. Like 33 both died of like a speedball, I guess.
Speedball, yeah. Yeah. I mean, Sandler's now iconic in its own right. His beautiful musical tribute to Farley, which we talked about on the show, which he performed on his 100% Fresh special on Netflix, as well as performing it again on his recent SNL hosting gig. He has a line in that song about Farley, worshiping the likes of Belushi and John Candy. And how his friends, you know, be like, oh, well, hey, be careful. You're going to die like those guys. Like, well, those guys are my heroes. That's just dandy. Like, yeah. So, that was always, I think, in his DNA, unfortunately. But we can get into that later on. Also, I should say at the front that, you know, Farley as a person, as a performer, as a comedian, as a person now with a legacy many decades later, he is so much more than the sad details of his life. And I don't want to, you know, do the armchair psychology thing and get too much into his addictions. Clearly, it is a part of the story, but I also don't want to be salacious about it.
Yeah. And so where his path really officially sort of intersects with this podcast is, I mean, obviously Saturday Night Live, you know, as Chris, you were saying, now, you know, he was a big bright star on that show. And in 1995, or I guess in 1994 when they would have shot it, but they basically Tommy Boy, which was originally called
Billy the Third, a Midwestern, which is a great title.
And this was literally this was, according to what I read in Spade's autobiography, this was just an idea or a pit, like basically just like, it was basically just bought by Paramount on the premise of like, well, like David Spade and Chris Farley are good together. Like, especially like the way Spade puts it, this is weirdly lopsided. I should have done this backwards. I should have read the Farley thing before the Spade thing. But according to him, they were really good together not just in the skits, but like in the office. Like they were apparently like, and apparently that's where Fat Guy and a Little Coke comes from, is Farley doing that in their office to like cheer Spade up or to get a laugh out of him. So this project came about where, you know, Fred Wolf, like, oh, well, no, it was originally written by the people who created That 70s Show and Third Rock from the Sun.
The Turners.
And then Fred Wolf came in and polished it, like gave it more of their sense of humor. Fred Wolf, obviously, he's been attached to all these Sandler movies. Right. He's a writer. He directed The House Bunny.
I didn't realize he directed House Bunny. That's great. So just to give a bit more context on Wolf, because I've read the Chris Farley Show. I, the other day, rewatched Tommy Boy with Peter Siegel's commentary, the director of Tommy Boy. I think Spade gets into this in his book too, but like, yeah, so there was the initial script written by the Turners for what became Tommy Boy, what was in, you know, Billy the Third and Midwestern. And I, as I understand it, Wolf doesn't even have an official credit.
Correct.
On Tommy Boy, but like they liked like the meat or like kind of like the bones of the script. But everyone kind of agreed that it needed a lot of work. And as I understand it, or, you know, like kind of like going from the accounts of Peter Siegel of Spade, like a lot of Tommy Boy was written on the fly. And like Fred Wolf would get together with Peter Siegel, like, you know, like while they were shooting, and they just hole up in their hotel room and stay up real late and just bang out scenes together, often based on experiences from their own life. Like Peter Siegel's like, oh, well, like I was once pumping my gas and I like screwed up my door because I miscued like the distance from like my car, blah, blah, blah. And like Fred Wolf, like, oh, well, one time I was changing the oil and I forgot to take the can out and that fucked up the hood. And so they would include these little things. And in addition to that, you know, like at one point on set, they overheard Farley and Spade talking, and like Farley comes out of his trailer wearing like a nice sharp sports coat. He's like, hey, David, does this coat make me look fat? No, your face does. And they're like, whoa, write that down. And like, they put it into the movie. So it's interesting to think about how a lot of Tommy Boy was crafted on the fly, because when you watch it, it feels like such a like confidently crafted movie, especially in comparison to Black Sheep, which for all that I like about Black Sheep feels very like very more so slapdash and
Black Sheep. That's a great point, because Black Sheep is way, especially watching them back to back as I did today. It's like Black Sheep is so much more haphazard, mm-hmm. And so much less like, you know, Tommy Boy gives you the bones must have just been the road trip plotline.
And the road trip plotline goes a long way, I think, into kind of having that through line to hang like the bits on. Whereas Black Sheep, like, well, we got to have Spade and Farley together. Let's find a way to hold them up in a cabin and just have them do bits, which is fun to watch because it's Farley and Spade. But it's also like, you can see just how much more of a slam dunk Tommy Boy really feels like. In comparison and in retrospect.
I'll say it's interesting that like Spade in his autobiography seems to, it doesn't come across as like false modesty. He seems to genuinely like be a little bit deprecating about his own roles in these films. Like he's a little bit like, he's like, Chris was obviously a star and I was like trying to keep up. Mm-hmm. I was like trying to like, and you know, him keeping up, like he sort of like does that low energy, doesn't care sort of thing is like his shtick. And so it doesn't look like, there's not a lot of flop sweat evident, which is good. He mentions like his favorite line and his favorite joke of his in Tommy Boy being the, I think it's in Tommy Boy when he, When Chris Farley's wearing, he's like, "Oh, it's a clip-on." And yeah, are you sure? Oh, are you sure? And he's just like, and he's like, "Those are my favorite kinds of jokes for me. Is just the kind of thing that won't bust a gut on the first couple of viewings, but on like viewing like 8 or 9, you're like, oh, that's really funny."
And you remember them too, like. And again, I'm glad I watched the Tommy Boy again with the Siegel commentary. I'm not. You know, I think I've seen, you know, a few other of his movies, like, you know, he's like a sturdy kind of workman with a lot of like SNL or SNL adjacent comedies. Not like one I would like most of us would think of as like in the pantheon of comedy directors, but clearly he can deliver what he's delivering at. And clearly he knows who and how, who to work with and how to work with them effectively. Like Tommy Boy could have been a disaster when you sort of get into the behind the scenes elements of it, and how like they weren't really like they were kind of flying with a loose script and just the kind of brilliant but tricky chemistry of Farley and Spade and all that. But he talks about how a lot of that movie was, yes, like he and Fred Wolf kind of throwing like personal anecdotes together and just kind of using what they saw with a lot of Farley and Spade, like off camera and then making that in front of the camera. But he also talks interestingly about the movie kind of finding itself in the editing room as well, and how a lot of the sweetness that really pervades Tommy Boy, and why I think it's still such like a perennial favorite of not just like movie fans, but like just, you know, casual TNT watchers. Like it's like, you know, Tommy Boy is one of those home video and cable staples, I think, in the decade since. But like he talks about, you know, just like the sweetness of the movie with Tommy and Brian Dennehy, and just like the growing sweetness between Spade and Farley and all that. Like a lot of it was just found in the editing room and just finding like these little beats to end scenes on that weren't just pratfalls, but like people smiling at Tommy.
So yes, I remember, I have not done this in over a decade, but I had that Holy Schnikey edition DVD of Tommy Boy. And I remember that commentary, and Spade in his book, for a different reason, singles out the editor of Tommy Boy, talking about how he made, like, he was like talking about the scene where he's being sarcastic to the gas station attendant, and yes, Spade mentions like, oh, you get 3 laughs instead of 1 because you cut to his reaction and you cut back to me, and yes, you cut, and like that's, you know, that's really good. But I very specifically remember, and I've always, it's been one of these weird things, because I used to listen to any audio commentary I could get my hands on for any movie, didn't matter. And the Tommy Boy one, I've always remembered this, because I think at like age 16 when I listened to it, I was like, oh, that's really interesting, I never thought of it like that. But he specifically uses the example of in the factory, yes, where Dennehy, like, he's like, come on, Tommy. And then he's like, come on, Dad. And you get this very quick. And this time around, I actually noticed how quick the moment was. So it really does feel like he picked a scrap of footage off the ground and like put it in this position. But Dennehy just gives this very warm, loving smile, and ending the scene on that.
Yes.
Does, as Peter Siegel acknowledges in the commentary, it does weirdly, like, not to like claim that like the movie has like, I wouldn't sit here and be like the movie has like an actual like genuine emotional like core necessarily, but it does give the, like, it doesn't feel cheap or tossed off or like, oh, like this is the part where we're supposed to care about, like, you know, yeah, he's sad about his dad or whatever. It's like, oh no, there's a genuine warmth of a feeling there that I think makes, yeah, Tommy Boy's just Tommy Boy's a better movie than Black Sheep.
Very
yeah.
much. I think Siegel talks too about the scene, like the big wedding reception when Big Tom has a heart attack and drops dead. And Siegel talks about sort of like, you know, but like believing in the material in the scene, but also being a little trepidatious, like when he like showed up like a rough cut to a test audience and people were laughing. Mm-hmm. When then he dropped, he's like, oh God, we're fucked. This isn't supposed to be funny. Like this is the emotional like catalyst of the movie. And then I think he says, you know, after some more editing and post-production, like, you know, David Newman, of like the you know, like the very famous Newman family, who does the quite lovely score for Tommy Boy, adds in that bagpipe Amazing Grace over that scene. And then I think Siegel talks about how it plays, how it clicked as soon as they added in that music, and like a lot of people were ready to buy it. We're spending all this time talking about the sweetness of Tommy Boy, and I don't want to like oversell it for people who haven't watched it in a while or who haven't seen it yet, but I think that definitely does speak to its longevity as a movie. It's a very, very funny movie, and people remember all these great bits for lots of reasons, but it does feel very grounded. And the movie does quite well in grounding itself in those opening scenes with Dennehy and all that. But, you know, that's also the magic of Dennehy, I think, as well.
Yeah. It's Tommy Boy, another interesting thing about Tommy Boy is the fact that, and it's why we decided to sort of, after the Grandma's Boy palate cleanser, we sort of decided to rewind it to Farley, because, you know, this is filming at the same time as Billy Madison is filming. And that's specifically the reason why they changed the name, because they didn't want Farley to be, you know, named Billy, you know, when there was another Saturday Night Live alum who had a starring role as a Billy. And it's just interesting because, you know, there is the very, you know, there's always been with Farley, the sort of like what could have been, just in general, not necessarily just for his film career, but the fact that these were happening simultaneously. And we know what happened with Sandler. Sandler just, you know, went into the stratosphere. And I think it's probably likely that if he had, you know, been able to keep his stuff together, Farley would have been like within that realm. But yeah, and Tommy Boy definitely, you know, it's like if something had happened to Sandler after The Waterboy, and he'd never made another movie, I think that Billy Madison, I don't know if it would be like as seismic a thing as it is now, but it would definitely be like Tommy Boy is now, where it's just like, oh, like just something people would see, you know, it's like, oh, that movie. Yeah. I saw that movie 100 times on video as a kid. Like I saw, and that's definitely the place that Tommy Boy and Black Sheep, honestly, like they both did fairly well. It seems they made almost identical amounts of money, like $33 million in theaters. And both of them were big, big, video like rentals and sales. Tommy Boy, as you mentioned, is directed by Peter Siegel. Peter Siegel had directed, I believe, Naked Gun 33 and a third, which you see a little cameo in the hotel room. You see Naked Gun 33 and a third in Spade and Farley's room. And he is we've discussed him several times on the podcast because he is the director of Anger Management. He is the director of 51st Dates, and he is the director of The Longest Yard.
I honestly had forgotten about that. Wow, yeah, that's cool. So yeah, he's definitely in the family for sure.
Yes,
yeah.
For sure. And he's done. He also, you know, he's almost exclusively exclusively comedy. He's a comedy dude. He did the Get Smart movie with Steve Carell. He did The Nutty Professor 2, The Clumps. Not the first one, but right. The second one.
I have weirdly seen Get Smart like 3 times. It does not need to be seen 3 times, but there was just like one weekend when I was like in Chicago actually with my parents, and we were holed up in a hotel. And I don't know, like I guess our like it was a weekend where Get Smart was like the only thing that was playing on like HBO, and like our channels were limited, and through just the time that we were spending there, I wound up watching that goddamn thing like 3 or 4 times. It's unfortunately burned in my memory because of that.
I guess you had to have Showtime to watch The Love Guru.
I read yesterday that he was like, Spade really wanted him to direct Black Sheep too.
Well, yeah, because I don't know if there was bad blood, like amongst the Saturday Night Live guys with Penelope Spheeris because of whatever happened with Wayne's World, which I've always been a little bit unclear on. But with regards, I know we will sort of break these two films apart and talk about them more in depth separately. But basically, my understanding of it, or at least the way Spade, who acknowledges that there are multiple versions of the production history out there, But he, the way he puts it is that they brought on Penelope Spheeris, and basically, like, she immediately was like, I don't think the script's any fun, like, any good. Like, she basically, like, fired Fred Wolf from the movie. She was like, I know how to make both of you funny. But what that appears to have meant was, I really like Chris Farley and will do my best to make him look funny. And Spade, you know, she is on the record as saying, it, way past Black Sheep, she's on the record as saying, David Spade has never made me laugh. Ever, which is weird because her very next movie starred David Spade.
Right.
Senseless. But she said that, which Spade acknowledges in his book. And he, now he kind of speculates. He's like, you know, I think it must, I'm pretty sure, he was like, I don't know why people were treating her like a genius, because I'm pretty sure it was Mike Myers and Dana Carvey that made Wayne's World so great. I don't want to get into that because she, you know, Wayne's World is a great movie. Her documentaries, The Decline of Western Civilization, like, those things are brilliant. I don't want to get into, like, oh, Suburbia is great. She's made great movies. But it is, I'll just say, he, based on her saying that about Spade and Spade's own dissatisfaction with, he's like, you know, there are a lot of scenes in that movie which just Chris off by himself. And the whole thing about Tommy Boy was us together. Mm-hmm. And whether you agree or not that, like, Spade plus Farley was as good or better than, you know, Farley by himself, it's undeniable, at least to me, even if I had not heard any of this, it seems like the movie does not care about David Spade. Like, he is really an afterthought compared to Farley. And, like, again, you can take that however you want. I know people, there are people who really despise David Spade. Then it's fine, but.
If I can just add one quick thing, because you're right, like, we don't need to or have the time to really get into all of the quite fascinating and, like, sort of juicy perspectives with regards to Penelope Spheeris's 90s comedy work. I'll just say for the record, I think she's a fascinating and brilliant filmmaker. A lot of our sources that we're reading, like the Chris Farley Show, David Spade's book, you know, this and that, are probably going to be coming from the perspective of looking at her with some askewness. Just a real quick shout out, though, for folks interested in her as a person, as a filmmaker, and maybe a bit more insight from her perspective. A couple of years ago, I did listen to her appearance on WTF, the Marc Maron podcast. And they talk about her whole career, and her whole career is way bigger than, you know, these two, than Black Sheep, of course. But I would recommend that as, like, a good listen. And she does kind of get into Wayne's World and Black Sheep and all that, several years after the fact. So that's worth checking out just from a different, just for a different perspective. I will say that, like, you know, her work as, like, not just a documentarian of musicians, but, you know, just looking at Wayne's World and kind of the rock and roll energy of that movie. And I was mentioning this to you fellas earlier when we were texting, but, like, I feel like Black Sheep really comes alive during that sequence when Farley goes to Seattle and he's at, like, a rock concert.
The Rock the Vote, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Like it's like the movie pumps into this energy and just, like, this level of just kind of confidence of Farley getting there and, like, sort of pretending to be like a security bouncer and scaring off some punks, and then, like, he goes and stumbles into
I think it's literally happening behind you as you're saying this. I think it's
on. Oh, you're absolutely right. It is. That's hilarious. he goes into, like, the wrong, like, green room and is hanging out with, like, Rastafarian, like, musicians, and gets high with them and like learns a bit about white privilege and the man keeping, you know, the black man down, and, like, you know, and, like, like, the sort of rock and roll energy that Spheeris films Farley when he's on stage talking about how voting kicks ass, like, the movie becomes, like, shifts into a different gear that just isn't present for those scenes when it's, like, Farley and Spade trying to trap a bat in a bed sheet, like, which is funny because it's Farley and Spade and that's funny, but it's, yeah, it, like, Tommy Boy feels like a movie. Black Sheep feels like a loosely assembled series of scenes.
Well,
that just that are overall quite fun. And like, and if the general consensus, like Tommy Boy is the like the real good one, Black Sheep kind of sucks, I would say that Time has been kind of Black Sheep, and I actually am pretty fond of it. I think it has lots of moments, but yeah, I think going into it with the understanding that the production was a little rocky is good context.
Well, so yeah, that is just very weird that like how based on their respective production histories, it should have been the other way around.
But
it just very much feels like Black Sheep feels like a movie where they were like, I don't know, let's put these two people in a movie and see if we can come up with something funny for them to do every day. Like, and yeah, it's very weird. Like I said, haphazard. Tommy Boy, like I said, came out in 1995. This movie has two, you know, so Tommy Boy is about Tommy Callahan, Chris Farley, his dad, played by Brian Dennehy, make a note of that. His dad, played by Brian Dennehy, owns Callahan Auto Parts. They make like brake pads. They're in Sandusky, Ohio. And it's great, like sort of industry town. And at the beginning of the movie, shades of, you know, so here's an interesting thing. So he's graduating college after being there for 7 years, and he's going to go back and make daddy proud by working for him. So again, this is a very different movie from Billy Madison, but there are the interesting sort of parallels there. Like it's like, oh, it's a big high concept thing where he's got to, I mean, even though his dad's dead for most of the movies, he's like, got to prove himself to dad.
But like, and you know, there are those surface level similarities between Billy Madison and Tommy Boy at the beginning. Like Tommy is, you know, like, you know, a fuck up. He's been to college for 7 years. He's barely passing. Like he passes with a D+. You know, he's writing in Herbie Hancock instead of John Hancock. You know, clearly like movie sort of setting him up to be a buffoon. But you immediately see the distinction between Billy and Tommy, as it were, when Tommy arrives home to Sandusky. And like the second he sets foot into Callahan Auto, everyone's like, hey, Tommy, like, and slapping his back. And it's not just like they're kissing ass for like the boss's son. It's like, no, like the movie is very sincerely establishing this as like a small town company, a family company, and people like Tommy. And Tommy likes them, like, and everyone is accepting and fond of him, even though, or because the fact that he's kind of a big goof. Whereas like with Billy, which is obviously a much more absurd and surreal movie, is just kind of showing him to be a generally despised ass, like just like piece of shit by everyone. So from like the first 5 minutes on, their similarities start to end.
Yeah, these early SNL movies, kind of between this Black Sheep and Tommy Boy, I feel like there's a little bit of like there's pieces taken from out of a like a playbook of like, okay, this is, it's going to start out as like the fuck up kid who's got to win his dad over, or there's a lot of similarities between Tommy Boy and Black Sheep that we'll get into.
Well, it's so funny. And it's almost like, and we've said our piece many times on Billy Madison, but it is almost funny to compare the two, where it's like, oh, like lovable fuck up, except Billy Madison doesn't really seem to try and make him lovable at all. Like I know we talked about slumming love interest, and again, we don't need to talk about that movie, but it is funny. 'Cause you're right. It does like go such a long way that like Farley is such a likable presence. And like, you see the way that his dad reacts to him and how his father's, you know, workers react to him, with the exception of Spade and obviously like Rob Lowe, like with the exception of Spade, like everyone seems to love this guy. And that's just not, that's something that maybe that speaks to something like Billy Madison did well or did interestingly, was like not really having that. Like it's like, oh, do you like this person? Oh, we don't really care. It was kind of a crazy gamble. 'Cause yeah, you would think it's like, okay, like do we want to make sure the audience doesn't hate this character. I have to say, Brian Dennehy, the late great Brian Dennehy plays, Tommy's dad, Tom Callahan. And Brian Dennehy, I mean, you've seen him in a gajillion movies. He's was a legend and a treasure. And I just have to say, I share with Chris Farley the fact that we each once had, we were once had our fathers played by Brian Dennehy in a movie. So just a little Easter egg for the fans out there.
I did want to ask you about that, Wilson, not to go down the whole Terrence Malick detour, but you were able to, you know, work on a movie that included Dennehy. Did you ever get to meet him or work with him directly?
Yes. So the first day before I got cast in my one scene role that was cut from the film, before I got cast, Dennehy came. Dennehy was playing the father of Christian Bale's character in Knight of Cups and also the father of Wes Bentley's character. And I was a PA, so I was there on set every single day. And my job the day that Brian Dennehy got there to set, we were filming in this old office building in downtown Los Angeles. There was no elevator. You had to walk up all these stairs. Mr. Dennehy was a little bit less mobile than, like, you know, it took him a little bit of time to, like, go up and down the stairs. And my job was basically, you know, he had to, like, walk around and sort of have these little monologues to himself, you know, being sad. He's this very broken up, tortured, tormented dad in this movie. He's great in the film, by the way. If you watch that movie, Knight of Cups, Brian Dennehy is on, he's in the movie giving a good performance. But he, what was nice was that I was basically entrusted with getting him anything he needed. Like, they were like, Wilson, hang by Brian Dennehy and just, like, get him whatever he needs. And so I had, like, a folding chair for him, and he'd come sit down, and I'd say, like, you know, Mr. Dennehy, do you need anything? And, you know, I think every time he was like, no, like, thank you, I'm fine. Like, I have everything I need. And then he asked me, he goes, what's your name, kid? And I go, oh, well, it's Wilson. And then he goes, oh. And then he just goes, Wilson, what are we gonna do? Wilson, I'm sorry. And I'm just sort of chuckling to myself. And he goes, Wilson, I bet you that annoys the hell out of you. I bet you get that all the time. And it does. And I did. But I told him, I was like, Mr. Dennehy, it's totally fine when you say it. Like, you can say as much as you want. He was like, all right, good man. And later, I just remember rapping that night. We were done filming. And I had to go down and, like, help people load equipment into the trucks. And so I was sort of standing at the bottom of the stairs, making sure everyone was getting down safe. And Mr. Dennehy was one of the last people down. And he comes out and he sees me, and just in full view of everyone, he goes, Wilson. And so, yeah, he was delightful. He was great to work with. And then, yeah, in the one scene where I was thrown into, I mean, aside from my cameo in the elevator, the one scene where I actually was thrown into a scene, I was walking right in front of him as he was shouting at Christian Bale. You know, they were having a knockdown drag out fight, and I had to sort of, like, be in the middle of that. And it was really, really strange and surreal. But yeah, Brian Dennehy was a great actor. Also gets it's not his voice, unfortunately, but he gets one of the best jokes in South Park, the movie, when they sing, what would Brian Boitano do? And he's just like, hello? And like, who the fuck are you? And he's like, I'm Brian Dennehy. Like, no, get the fuck out of here. the other weirdly personal connection I have to Tommy Boy is that I grew up in the town of Columbus, Georgia, a town that no one has any reason to know anything about for any reason.
Columbus, Georgia, not Columbus, Ohio.
And it might as well have not existed, because obviously it's never mentioned in any movie or book or show. But I remember as a kid, friends were like, oh no, they talk about Columbus and Tommy Boy. And then when I watch Tommy Boy, every time I see it, I give, like, a little cheer when the guy's like, that's because it's going to Columbus, Georgia, not Columbus, Ohio. You see those little letters? That's the state. And it's like, oh boy, that's my hometown. Good riddance.
One more quick shout out to Dennehy as Big Tom. But and this is, again, going from that Peter Siegel commentary, which is worth a listen if you're a fan of Tommy Boy. But he's talking about the early scene leading up to, like, the big wedding. And it's, you know, that kind of quiet scene between Big Tom and Farley, like, you know, getting their tuxes ready and all that. And so, like, in the scene, it's basically Big Tom kind of having sort of like a vulnerable moment with his son, saying like, hey, I hope you're okay with the fact that, like, you know, I'm getting remarried. And, you know, and like, it's talked about how, you know, Tommy's mom died when he was younger and that kind of a thing. And apparently, as written, the scene was a lot more dialogue heavy and like explicit with like the emotions and the themes. And according to Peter Siegel, Dennehy, when they were about to film it, or maybe they had done a few takes of the scene as written. And then he was like, hey, do you mind if I try something a little different? Like, you know, this is kind of probably a buttoned up, you know, Midwestern dude who probably isn't used to talking like this, even with his son. Do you mind if I kind of like stumble around the words instead of saying them out loud? And Siegel, to his credit, was like, yeah, sure. Like, do it your way, Brian. And he does it as it is seen in the movie, where he's just kind of hinting at what he's trying to say. And then,
oh yeah.
And then Farley's just sort of like, you know, I get it, Dad. And again, it's one of those early grounding moments of the movie that, according to Siegel, was disarmingly sweet for like a lot of the studio brass whenever they would watch early cuts. And, you know, I think that that's a credit not only to like Dennehy as a fine actor, which we already know, but like just that story I thought was really, you know, a credit to, I guess, him like as a pro, like, you know, this like did like, you know, like Tommy Boy is this SNL upstart star vehicle. He's like fourth, fifth build in it. You know, it could be just a quick check throwaway. And he's actually showing up to have those, to like deliver those moments and those, and like, and those instincts and that type of contribution. So that speaks to him.
Yeah. It actually does make the scene better that he, sure. Like, yeah. Cause like hearing about it the other way, it's like, oh yeah, he would be a little bit less articulate about it.
Mm-hmm. I feel like him also like his like dying in this scene makes this movie probably much works better, makes it work better than Black Sheep. Like, because Black Sheep is trying to get acceptance of his brother. Here, he's trying to just get his dad to be proud of him and his work. And it's just, I think there's just something sweeter with it as it goes on versus in Black Sheep, where it's like, well, it's like my brother and then this kid.
Yeah.
Well, it's
off in Black Sheep.
It gives it a little bit more like of an emotion. I don't like emotional stakes in a way, because like you watch Black Sheep and it's at a certain point, it's just like, well, am I supposed to care about, like, again, like you don't need, like, I love Dirty Work, and Dirty Work is barely functions as like a movie like object, like, or something with a plot. But like something like Black Sheep, it's like, okay, well, what do we want? What does the audience want for these characters? It's like, well, do we really want his brother to become the governor? And it's like, well, that's nominally what's driving everything. And I guess in a generic sort of way, Farley wants his brother to not think that he's a loser, but his brother never actually seems to think he's a loser, even when he is actively fucking up his campaign. And so it's like, what's the stake here? It's like, if his brother doesn't win the governorship, it seems like he'll still be fine. Like, he'll still be whatever. And it's like, so like, obviously Tommy Boy has the, like, the pressing thing of like, well, the factory is going to close and all these people are going to lose jobs. But there's that sense of like, there's that connection to this person who really cared for him and loved, you know, and really like made him who he is. And like, without, you know, putting too fine a point on it, it's just like, yeah, like he's, you know, he's trying to do it for his dead dad. And I think that, yeah, having, you have a guy like Brian Dennehy doing that work at the beginning of your movie, like to get the audience sort of like, it's like, I mean, you'd be sad if your dad was Brian Dennehy and you lost him. So, yeah. So in Tommy Boy, so the scene that we've been talking about where Dennehy sort of changed it up to for the better. He introduces Tommy to his new love, who is played by Bo Derek, who famously was in the movie 10, very unsubtly referenced with an 80-yard line from Farley where he says, wow, she's like a 10. Yeah, just rough stuff. And then so Bo Derek is marrying, she was a counselor at a I guess like a weight loss camp or a weight loss like program that Dennehy was doing. And her son, played by Rob Lowe, was there. Rob Lowe shows up, and he's clearly, you know, he's like, it looks like, you know, not like a kind of a bad customer. Interestingly enough, Rob Lowe, not credited in the movie. And it's not a cameo. It's a role. He's not credited. And what I read was that, I don't know how contractual obligation things work like this for billing, but he was apparently, there was something to do with the mini series of The Stand, the McGarris, The Stand. And he, like, there was some amount of like red tape or maybe SAG, maybe that, like, there was a Screen Actors Guild union issue. There was something where he wasn't like going to be allowed to take on this role in Tommy Boy because of his obligations for The Stand. And his way around that, because apparently he and Chris Farley were pretty good friends, his way around that was to just not be billed in the movie at all. Wow. Which is crazy. So we get Rob Lowe. He and Farley go out on a wild night on the town. They go cow tipping. This is one of my favorite lines when Rob Lowe, he answers the door for Rob Lowe. It's just a line reading that I think about a lot. When he's like, hi, and he holds out his hand to shake, and Farley just goes, brothers don't shake hands, brothers gotta hug. And like, yeah, that's something I think about a lot, like weirdly a lot.
That's definitely a line that is repeated a lot, with people who are brothers or consider themselves brothers.
And you have like, so they go cow tipping, and they afterwards they're like he's like using the hose at the gas station, like hosing Farley off. And Farley does the like, I'm a maniac. Boy, he's a live wire in this, and it's great.
And apparently that was ad-libbed again.
Oh yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so he gets let's see, Farley, his dad gives him a job at the auto parts firm factory. weirdly, the bit about the fridge is also great, where the one joke is funny, where he's like, wow, a fridge, you could put a six pack of soda? And then like that's funny, and that would be enough. But then he keeps going, like, you can put that, and then finally Denny is just like a little bit impatient. He's just like, anything you want to keep cold, just to get him to stop naming things. Farley meets this he's kind of having a hard time on the job. You know, he doesn't understand that some things go to Columbus, Georgia, shout out. Not Columbus, Ohio. And then he meets this woman, this employee, who, like, you know, inputs stuff into the computer, I guess. She's like the logistics coordinator.
This is Julie Warner, who is probably mostly known for her role as, you know, like the very kind of sweet, earthy Michelle Brock and Tommy Boy, but also she was in Doc Hollywood with Michael J. Fox.
Right.
Now, I have not seen Doc Hollywood, but as I understand it, she kind of has like a, you know, for a certain generation, sort of a Phoebe Cates in Fast Times-esque Mr. Skin sort of fame from Doc Hollywood. Apparently there's like a nude scene, I don't know. But yeah, so her legacy is secure from showing up in some of these generational comedy classics.
Absolutely.
I really like her and Tommy Boy. She I feel like I'm overusing the word grounded, but this movie does, you know, ground the absurd moments with this kind of close-knit small town factory community, and you know, I enjoy Farley's chemistry with her, because it's not like they don't like make her out to be like some like, you know, kind of Veronica Vaughn-esque sex pot or anything like that. She's like, oh, she's like this nice lady who works there. Oh, and also, oh, Michelle, I sat next to you in history. Hey, do you remember your brother Dwayne? He just, you know, kind of like a goofball who knows her back from high school. And, you know, like most everyone else, she's like, oh yeah, Tommy, he's a sweet kid. And they, you know, and like their bond and tentative romance, you know, proceeds fairly organically. And the movie doesn't put really too high stakes on it. Like eventually they have their kind of climactic kiss at the end, but that's not really the triumph of the movie. The triumph of the movie is Tommy succeeding and saving the company. So as far as slumming love interest goes, this movie does not really make her slum.
Right. Oh, and you know what? It's funny. It's funny in talking about the movie, we did skip over the fact that when he gets back from college, David Spade picks him up from the airport. You just reminded me because I was thinking about product placement, and you get some M&Ms, some peanut M&Ms in the scene with Spade is driving Farley in his prized possession car. Just watching those peanut M&Ms just roll across the front of Spade's car. He's like, yeah, it really ups the resale value.
They have a thin candy shell.
I think there's a thin candy shell around your brain. A lot of people go to college for 7 years. I know, they're called doctors. Spade, you know what? Spade is self-deprecating in his book about his performance in these films. And obviously Penelope Spheeris did not think very much of his talents. I think 100% in Tommy Boy, I think that they play off each other very, very well. And I think that Spade has some of his like funniest line deliveries, like in his entire career.
Absolutely.
In this movie. And he does such a good job of playing against Farley. And in the way of like, there's just like an interesting, like, you know, Spade can easily tilt over into being a screen persona that you don't like. Like that he's like obnoxious and kind of like he's so smarmy that it's just like, oh, you just want to like hit him. And there's something about like there's a fine balancing act that he does in this where he's like mostly, because if he was too hard on Farley, I think the audience would just turn on him like very, very quickly. And there's enough of like, you can see why someone would find maybe Chris Farley obnoxious, but he knows how to modulate it enough, or knows where to sort of cut that to where it's not like, wow, this miserable bastard, like, why won't he get the stick out of his ass?
Yeah. And like the movie, you know, this is a 95 minute SNL comedy. So it's not like trying too hard to like, you know, give these characters too much depth, but the movie I think does a good job of kind of setting up not just like their dynamic, which is so great, but gives a little bit of like, I guess like emotional context to Spade's character. Like when they're having the kind of like their big second act knockout drag out fight, Spade has this line where, you know, he's like, you know, like I didn't have a father growing up and your old man looked out for me and I looked up to him. And, you know, and I worked my way up in the company, and you, I've just seen you like fail your entire life, and it's always okay because you're Big Tom's son. So, and again, like, you know, that's not, I don't want to oversell it or overstate it, but if you sort of think of it from that point of view of like this guy who, you know, valued Big Tom as well as a father figure, and then he's just sort of seen Farley fall on his ass his entire life and always have like, you know, and like knowing that he'll always be okay and have that security no matter what, you could sort of see why that bitterness would be there. And later on when like they're making up, Spade says like, look, you did your best. You had like, and like, I consider you a friend now, and maybe that doesn't mean much to you, but I don't have many friends kind of a thing. So there's a bit of a through line there of like, oh yeah, this guy's kind of a dick, but he's clearly also lonely.
Yeah. He's got his fair share of like humbling moments of things that happened to him that just also help like give his character a little bit of quality that you're like, oh, I feel bad for him for whenever his hair blows back and he's got the bald cap on. Or there's like a moment somewhere around like the hotel and watching Tommy. But yeah, there's things in here that just like really give him a little bit more to be caring about.
I thought it was really poignant when he almost got to jack off.
Were you watching Spectrovision?
buddy whack it.
Sinner.
Sinner. turns out so Big Tom sadly dies on his wedding day. It's terrible, sad, upsetting thing. And it turns out that I'm a little fuzzy on some of these details. I was also like doing some household chores because I'd seen Tommy Boy so many times. Basically, the company is in danger of being bought out. Callahan Auto Parts is in danger of being bought out. And if that happens, then like, you know, I guess the factories will shut down and like all these people in town will be out of work. And basically, the only way to avert this, well, first of all, they need a loan from the bank, which the bank won't give them. And so Tommy says like, well, what if I just like give all like my inheritance and my shares and all that and put that up as collateral? Could we get the loan? And they're like, well, I guess. And he also has to sell however many brake pads. And even though he's not a salesman like his dad was, he and David Spade, basically David Spade is enlisted to go with him to like show him the ropes and to try and go across, you know, all over the country or, you know, different places on a road trip and sell brake pads to people. And so that's what they do. Meanwhile, it turns out that Bo Derek and Rob Lowe are not mother and son, but rather lovers, and they are scamming. They are there to scam the Callahan family out of their money. It turns out they got a lucky break with Big Tom dying. So that means that all they have to do is like, you know, as long as the brake pads don't get sold, you know, they're good as gold. And so Rob Lowe throughout the whole movie, like as they start getting a little bit closer to their goal to Tommy and David Spade, he starts undertaking, you know, sort of underhanded methods to prevent that, such as attempting to destroy the trucks that are taking brake pads places. And eventually he does succeed in like diverting shipments, like fucking up the orders.
Yeah. Like he sneaks into Michelle's office and like fucks up her order invoices and stuff. So basically misnumbering orders, which then in turn makes the company look bad, which in turn means like all their clients and accounts are canceling those orders. So it becomes this whole domino effect of disaster.
And this is the scene where he backs into the vacuum thing and it just strips off his shirt.
Bucks his shirt off. Yeah.
And kudos to Lowe, who is a very, very handsome man.
It's weird how later in the movie, there's that scene where Rob Lowe, attempts to shoot out the trucks and he screws that up. And then later in the movie, he's by himself in that scene. And then later on in the movie, David Spade refers to him as Lee Harvey Oswald.
Oh, that's
right. I'm like, why would, what does that mean to you, David Spade? why would you call him that? You weren't there. but anyway, so it's a road trip movie and that gives it structure, you know, from this point on. And so it's basically just David Spade and Chris Farley, you know, driving around. They're trying to sell. Chris Farley is not good at selling. He kind of has this, as someone who has recently worked in sales, let me tell you, I totally feel Chris Farley when they're like, don't take no for an answer. Chris Farley's like, got it. And it's just the montage of, it's like, oh no, great. You know, thanks for your time. Sorry to bother you. And it's like, that's the struggle's real.
Sure. Like one of the most like miserable 3 months of my life was when I like bullshitted my way into like this, like decently like starting salary, but like essentially like a cold call, like office sales job. And oh God, like I like just all I could do was just like try to think of Tommy's lessons in the movie. And well, it was not a good fit.
And so they're having no luck whatsoever selling anybody on these brake pads. It's going really, really badly. You know, it's just like it's a skeleton to hang these funny gags on. Like maybe my favorite joke in the entire movie, which is the bit where Farley fucks up the door on Spade's car. And he arranges it in such a way. He arranges it in such a way that when Spade walks out to the car, and he's like, why didn't you pump any gas? And Farley's just like staring straight ahead. And he's just like,
they're all out.
They're out. And he's like, okay, well, all right, well, let's get going. And he pulls on the car door and just yanks it clean off. And Farley just goes, what'd you do?
Like, one Like just like for like as much as we think of Farley as being kind of like this cannonball of a physical presence and always so, so loud, like just you can watch this movie on mute and just look at his facial expressions and it's like, it's gorgeous. Like he was an artist, like, and like, or like even something as simple as that shot of him backing the car up and bending the door. He starts to shut off with like this big doofy smile. Like he's so excited to pump gas and then he fucks up the door and then just his face drops. Like it's so, so goddamn funny. And also too, and again, to cite the Peter Siegel commentary, he was like, oh, well, how, like, this is like a good gag, but like, how can we, you know, couch it into other jokes? And they've and like, oh, well, we can just show Tommy in the background, just trying to like fix the door through the window of the gas station while Spade is having his whole other thing with like the surly gas station attendant. And Siegel cites that to like his days working with the Zucker brothers. The gun and stuff. Yeah. That's fantastic. Yeah. And you know, again, just like with just this section of the movie with like the road trip and trying and failing to make these sales, there's that fantastic scene. I mean, maybe the best of Farley's movie career when he's kind of trying and failing to sell their client, you know, kind of like this stuffy dude. And he does like the whole thing of like miming and acting out like, you're driving along and like, ooh, that was close. And like, I'm not even going to pretend to like quote it or do it because I can't. Anyone listening to this far into the show knows what I'm talking about, but that scene is so funny. It's so over the top. And again, like, you know, I never really appreciated this until I watched it with the commentary and essentially was just watching it in a way on mute. And just sort of watch, you know, just like seeing like the visual comedy take place. But that scene is so great because Farley's doing this real over the top boisterous thing and doing all these voices. And he has like the can or like he has like the lighter that he's lighting it on fire. So it's that type of energy, but there's some fantastic cuts to like the client and then to the Spade just looking stunned and horrified. Like it's like this movie is quite well edited.
I like the bit, the running gag about him not getting his dad's like sort of pithy one-liner about like, you can stick your head up a bull's ass and take a look, but I'd rather take the butcher's word for it.
Right.
And he can't get it right.
It's gotta be your bull.
And there's there's also that line that's, I mean, essentially setting up that his dad is just an expert salesman that he's always going to live in the shadow of, that his dad could sell a popsicle to a ketchup popsicle to a woman in white gloves.
Hey, yeah, I like Farley. David Spade says that, and Farley's like, a ketchup popsicle? ridiculous. Yeah. They have that scene, typical road trip stuff. They hit a deer and the deer, they cry over that, which is funny. I'd forgotten that reaction. I had not forgotten that the deer wakes up in the backseat of the car and just like fuck shit up in a crazy way. The deer, incidentally, voiced by, it's not a CGI deer. This isn't Grown Ups 2 territory. The deer is voiced by Frank Welker, who just like voiced all the Transformers. Like I just clocked him in the credits and I was like, what the hell? What did he do? They go to this diner he's trying to convince the waitress to give him some wings. The waitress was supposed to be played by Roseanne Barr. And apparently scheduling didn't work out. I don't know who the actress is actually, but basically, she agrees to go make him some wings because he, you know, is confident and not, you know, he's self-assured. And as he tells Spade, he's like, well, we had the meat lover's pizza in the car. Like, if we didn't get the wings, it's not a big deal. And it's like, well, that's why you were so good there. And that leads to when that one person is like, well, the guarantee is right on the box. The guarantee, it's right on the box here. Why isn't your guarantee on the box? And he launches into that great, again, like a really fine bit of acting from Farley where he just suddenly like finds himself and he's just like, all right, well, let's think this through, my man. And he's like, you know, going through all of it where he's like, why, you know, I could take a shit in a box and give you a guarantee, but that wouldn't be very good, would it?
Next thing you know, there's money missing from your drawer and your daughter's knocked up.
Yeah.
like it's, if you kind of like parse out the logic of his whole little rant, it's kind of nonsense. It's not dissimilar from Billy's whole the puppy who lost his way kind of like revolution thing. But the difference being that's immediately shot down Billy Madison, but and Tommy Boy, it kind of like just like the weird sort of just confident car salesman logic of what he's doing works on the guy. Like, so why they put the guarantee on the box? Because they know all they sold you was a guaranteed piece of shit. Why don't you just buy a quality product from me? Like, kind of a thing. And it works. And he's able to build his confidence from there. Another quick shout out to like our road trip section. But one of my favorite bits, maybe my favorite joke of the whole movie, is it's kind of it's when they're still sort of like swinging and missing with their sales pitches, and they're just having like a rough time on the road. And Farley and Spade are like fighting over the radio stations, and like Farley picks like a rockin' song, and then Spade changes it to kind of like more of like a feminine pop tune. Farley's like, oh, that song sucks. And he switches it again. And then it's the Carpenters. And they both sort of do this like faux macho, like, oh, talk about lame. No kidding. Oh, I'm okay with it if you are. Yeah, sure. Whatever. I can live with it if you can. And then there's the beautiful cut of like the car driving, and then smash cut back to Farley and Spade just singing their hearts out, and their face is covered in tears listening to this sweet, sappy Carpenter song. I love it.
Well, no shade to this other movie, which is also very good, but there's a scene that was more or less wholesale stolen for Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle.
Okay.
Again, it's a great scene in both movies, but like watching Tommy Boy again, I was like, that's right. They did it. This movie did it first. That bit's great. They're selling more and more to people. By the way, we occasionally see commercials for this guy, Ray Zelinsky, played by Dan Aykroyd. And I can't be the only person that in this particular moment in time found it weird that to keep hearing the name Zelinsky again and again, it's spelled differently. But I was just like, oh man, like this is the second time I've heard the name Zelinsky. And it's in a very weird time and context for that. But yeah, he's like the big, you know, big head honcho, the one who like might be buying out Callahan Auto Parts. You know, they keep selling more and more brake pads to folks. They stay at the motel where you get fat guy in a little coat. You get Farley walking in on Spade, masturbating to a woman in the pool. And this is apparently when at the actual hotel where they were staying for the shoot. Apparently this was just something that Spade would literally do to Farley. He would knock on his door and just go, housekeeping! And just like get Farley like progressively madder and madder. And he said that Farley, he would do it like every day, and Farley like every single day would somehow forget. And he like opened the door in a fury, and he'd be like, oh, it's just you. And Spade's like, yeah, it's always just me, man. Like I'm always doing this. So those are great bit. Housekeeping, you want me? Let me jerk you off.
What kind of a hotel is this? And apparently they filmed different takes of like what is the funniest cut to Farley dropping the blanket? Like, is he bare-assed? Is he wearing like polka dot boxers? And they finally settled on like I guess like bikini underwear or something like that.
So apparently the way Spade puts that, Spade says that in his biography, he says that apparently because Sherry Lansing was the one who gave the green light to the movie. She was the head of Paramount at the time. She's married to William Friedkin. Got to meet her once. She's very, very nice. First female head of a major studio in Hollywood history. He wasn't drinking. Spade is very adamant that he wasn't drinking, like, or he wasn't abusing too much, like, on the set.
At this point in his life, he was a few years sober, I believe.
And Farley, apparently the take that they did where he was naked, apparently Farley very ostentatiously was like swinging his body in such a way that his dick kept popping into the shot. And he said, like, into the camera, "Do you like the movie, Miss Lansing?" And David Spade is like, "I'm certain that Peter Siegel made sure that daily never made it to Paramount." He's like, "I'm certain that the plug would have gotten pulled if that actually made it." So the director was probably like, "Yeah, just burn that one." So yeah, and then as we said, Rob Lowe does some underhanded shenanigans, and he deletes, he messes with some files so some people don't get some brake pads. And despite all of Spade and Farley's hard work, they're fucked. The Zelensky's auto parts are going to buy them and just strip them for parts. Like, they're not going to need the factories or anything. They just need the name, essentially. They won't count the Callahan name. Tommy is all despondent about that, until they realize, what's been going on, like, what's wrong. It's like, well, we got to get to Chicago before, you know, these papers get signed. We got to stop this deal from happening, save our town. This is a section I just completely blocked out, I've forgotten about, where they they sneak onto the plane as flight attendants. Farley going into the bathroom and getting his tie stuck in it's a good bit of physical comedy where he gets his tie stuck in the toilet, and then he like pulls himself out and he just like bursts through through the door.
And according to Siegel, this whole sequence was like one of the very few scenes that like they shot as it was written. The majority of the movie was either like improv and refined or like kind of written during production, whereas this bit was always written in the script, and they're like, and like they knew they didn't really have to fuck with it, like, oh yeah, I know, like this will be like this thing will play itself, and Chris and Spade, and like Chris and Spade can take care of it just fine.
So they go to Chicago, inside this the lobby of this building where Zelensky is. It doesn't sound right to say that. Where Dan Aykroyd is. Chris Farley accidentally gets mistaken for a bank robber by just walking in and be like, "Hey everyone, I need your attention." And everyone just immediately drops down. The security guards slide their guns over. They make it upstairs. But basically Dan Aykroyd, you know, he doesn't want to hear it, who cares? He just wants the name, blah blah blah.
The movie is weirdly, I don't want to say accidentally, nor do I want to like put too fine a point on this, but like this movie has like a fairly like realist, almost cynical bent on like capitalist like fuckery. In a way, because like Farley's whole thing was like, oh well, Ray seems like a nice guy on TV, he'll understand, like once I tell him that he's gonna screw over a whole town, like he'll let us off the hook. And then they're talking to Aykroyd, he has this whole great like walk and talk of like, oh well, my commercials are just what I do, and the American working man doesn't know any better, and they'll do what I tell them to do, and this and that. Like, it's a fairly like, you know, like it is a very working class movie, which is interesting. Like, by all accounts, Farley was a fairly conservative Republican dude.
Well, what you're saying is that the movie starts off as Farley's Billy Madison, but it ends as Farley's Mr. Deeds.
Wilson, way to bring it home.
Yes, it kind of reminds me too of is it David Koechner in Dirty Work, where he's got the car dealership and they want to fuck him over.
Right.
Well, yeah, like I was gonna say, when as you were saying that, Chris, I was like, I was contrasting that with like the belief in like the small industry town, like where everyone works at the factory and stuff, and like the sort of rosy portrait of that. And again, and before I made the Mr. Deeds connection, I was gonna say, it's like, well, if this movie cared just 10% more about any of that stuff, you could almost describe it as Capra-esque. But the movie that we actually have, you could not describe as Capra-esque. So anyways, they end up, I don't know, what, they get like a news crew to like basically like get Dan Aykroyd on camera being like, what are you going to do? Like, you know, like, don't you care about the American working man? And like, he basically is like pressured into, pressured into like not closing the factory or not like.
He has to commit like a major crime by like attaching fake bombs to himself, right?
Yes, he commits. He would have gone to Gitmo for the rest of his life for this crime that he committed, which is putting extracting explosives to his stomach as like a suicide bomb.
Which he was just previously faking being an airline attendant. So his like whole everything he's doing. This also happens in Black Sheep, where it's like, oh, well, at the end of this movie, he should be in prison.
But he basically bamboozles Aykroyd into buying like the full like order of brake pads that they lost from the other clients. Okay. Like, you're saving the company financially, and also now we don't have to sell to you.
Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, the day is saved. Hooray. We find out David Spade's bald and is wearing a wig. That's kind of funny. Back home, everything's hunky-dory, and there's a sweet little callback. Like, we've seen him like out on like we've seen Tommy out on his like sailboat before with Michelle, and then like at the end he's sort of like by himself like talking to his dad, like, you know, talking to his dad up in heaven and like, you know, waiting for a wind to come by, and this really nice breeze picks up, and it's like, you know, it's a touching moment. And that's Tommy Boy, and Tommy Boy is great. Rewatching it, Chris, we were sort of, before you jumped on the call, Austin and I were talking a little bit about this, but Tommy Boy is a movie that I actually did not see until the DVD, the Holy Schnikey edition. I was very aware of it and Black Sheep. I was super duper aware of it. Obviously loved Sandler, knew about Chris Farley, had not watched Tommy Boy until that DVD came out. And then once that DVD was out, I watched it all the time. Like, it became almost like a movie I would like put on like when I was going to sleep, when I was just needed something on, and listened to that commentary several times. All of this just to say, I know we're all on the record as being a big fan of this movie. All that is just to say that watching it again today, I was like, oh fuck, where has this been? Like, why have I not been watching this constantly? Like in the past, like, you know, it's like I've seen, because of circumstances, like I've watched Dirty Work twice in the past like 6 months. And that's like a somewhat of a similar vibe in a way, where I'm just like, wow, this is like comfort food to me. Mm-hmm. But Tommy Boy, especially, it's totally understandable why it gained such a following, like especially like home video, like and all that. Like, it's a really delightful movie. It's good natured in a way that doesn't blunt the comedy to an excessive degree. Like, it doesn't feel like, oh, like you really need this material to be rated R or anything like that. It doesn't feel like Spade and Farley are reining themselves in too much. Like it hits this really sweet spot of, you know, genuinely funny, like slapstick, pratfall, like SNL type humor. With like a core of not enough sweetness to overbalance anything, but just enough for it to seem sincere. And like, hey, we're not wasting your time with this element of the movie. Like, it's there. It's just there for a little sweetening.
I totally agree. I remember the release of like the Holy Schnikey special edition, like the 10-year anniversary, when by that point the movie was pretty firmly established as like this kind of cult classic.
There's like a quote along commentary on the DVD.
Yeah. I remember getting into Farley through probably like the early Sandler stuff, and then just like catching up with them both on SNL. And I vaguely recall like probably being aware of Tommy Boy and Black Sheep and probably catching them on like cable reruns, and then eventually renting them and watching them from, you know, start to finish. And it took me longer to come around on Black Sheep, but Tommy Boy was an early favorite. Eventually, like, I bought like an early version of like the DVD, and I watched all the time. What's interesting though is that like even then, back when like I was younger and like when we were at the age of being totally in the pocket for Farley, I remember thinking like maybe I was like at that teenage age where I was starting to like feel like somewhat like self-defeatingly snobby about some of these movies. And I remember thinking like, oh yeah, like Tommy Boy's good, but like obviously we're kind of grading it on a curve because poor Farley died, you know, too young, and you know, Tommy Boy's like, you know, a C+, but we're all kind of generous to it because he died too soon. I want to say for the record that I, you know, was just up my own ass because, yeah, like I watched it this week in the lead up to the show. I watched it and Black Sheep about a year or two ago, I think like during more like fraught lockdown days and being really just kind of like bowled over all over again. Like, wait, no, like this isn't like a movie we're grading on a curve. Maybe that's more true of some of the later stuff with Farley, but that's okay. We'll get to it. No, like Tommy Boy is just like a genuinely fun and funny and sweet movie. It is, I think, really well crafted for what it is. And when you get into Siegel's commentary, when you get into Spade's book and like the Farley biography, it's also kind of incredible how they kind of captured lightning in a bottle. Because given a lot of the kind of flying by the seat of their pants of the production and of this relatively lower budget production too, like it could have been a disaster, but they really nail it with just some good choices and not getting in their own way. Real quick detail about that you know, final scene when Farley is in the boardroom with Aykroyd and everyone else, the camera crews are there. There's this detail on the Siegel commentary that blew me away. Like, this was incredible to me, but he talks about how as it was initially written and filmed, it was just Farley and Spade and the news crew. And like the scene was just him talking into the camera and kind of putting Aykroyd on the spot and getting him to save the factory. When he watched the scene in the movie, there's all these very like funny and stirring pickup shots to not only his friends back at the factory who see that Farley's saving the company, but like you sort of see kind of like this like round robin of all the different people that they met on the road, like the waitress, some of the
clients, college roommates.
College roommates and like some of the clients they sold brake pads to, all kind of reacting to this news and either expressing excitement or disinterest or whatever. And that was like added as like a near post-production afterthought. Like they filmed it just with Farley talking to the camera. And like, it was just like the static scene of just him in the boardroom talking to the camera. And like after the fact, they're like, oh, like what if we added the other people, which is wild to me because you try to imagine that scene, just him in the camera, and it feels like a dead scene. And that, you know, very fun and funny montage of all the different people that he's met throughout the movie feels like so organic and like almost like a no brainer. And the fact that this movie was so successfully thrown together, I think really just speaks to good talent and good fortune.
There's that guy that was like the guarantees guy. That's like, I think I bought brake pads from him. I'm just going to turn back on cartoons.
Yeah. And I want to hear, Austin, we should get your thoughts on before we switch quickly over to Black Sheep. I want to hear some of your thoughts on Tommy Boy, or final thoughts. I just also have to say one other thing, and I think I can do this for so much in the movie, but something that I, as far as line readings that I think a lot about with Tommy Boy, that I take for granted, anytime, and I do genuinely mean anytime I hear the name or phrase John Hancock, literally every time that happens, I, in my head or under my breath or sometimes just out loud, I'll go, John Hancock, it's Herbie Hancock. And like I'll do that to the point where I think if you like ask me immediately, like if the most recent time I've done it, if someone was like, what's that from? I've been like, wait, what is that from? Like, what did I, like, I know I got it from somewhere. Like, what am I referencing? And so, yeah, it's a beautiful movie with a lot of beautiful quotable lines.
Yeah. I mean, it's infinitely watchable. I think I could watch this one over and over again.
Yeah. And I might watch it again tonight. Who knows?
Yeah. I remember, I guess I probably came across this, I think whenever I first like was introduced, I guess this would have came around the time of Billy Madison, both in 95, within probably a month of each other. So probably just a Blockbuster rental back then. But I remember being pretty bowled away by Chris Farley, and you know how sometimes they're like, write a letter in school to a historical figure, alive or dead. I wrote mine to Chris Farley. which I think he was maybe dead at that point. It was, I was probably 10. So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. But this, this is great. I mean, it's really, I would probably put it up if we had to rank this among the other Sandlers. I mean, I think it would be Billy Madison, this, and Happy Gilmore as like the most watchable.
I think that's fair. And just, you know, just talking or speaking to its legacy and its quotability. We mentioned earlier, Wilson, the brothers don't shake hands, brothers got a hug. You know, I see my dear brother-in-law, you know, a few times a year, and within 2 minutes, we're saying that to each other. I'm also thinking of like an old friend of mine who I think I've known probably since like middle school. We would do like, we grew up together, like middle school, high school. We went to the same schools as well as did like church functions together. And she's like an old friend of mine, but we were never like super, super close. But if we're ever like saying hi to each other online or just checking in with one another, which is rare now because, you know, we're all grown up, but like within 2 or 3 minutes of us catching up with each other, we are just quoting Tommy Boy to each other. Like it is a second language. And like, that's how we, like, it has become the thing that we do when we're just sort of expressing our affection to each other, like as friends. Like it, like the movie has, like weirdly has that type of longevity and power, I think.
I have to make my last point before we jump over to Black Sheep. And I didn't actually do this for Black Sheep, but I'm not necessarily going to be doing this for every movie. The categories don't necessarily have to hold from the holdover from the Sandler movies. I will say, product placement, you got your M&Ms. At one point, Michelle has a box of Dunkin' Donuts.
Yes.
And for the eagle-eyed fans out there, you know, another connection to Billy Madison is the scene where Rob Lowe gets his shirt sucked off and with his shirt pulled off of his body by the like tube. Right next to him is a box of Triscuit crackers. And so shout out to Triscuit, who was really getting, must have been a thing in the Saturday Night Live writer's room or something, because they're everywhere, man. Okay, so Tommy Boy comes out, does pretty well, kills it on home video, makes about $33 million domestic, which is good enough for them to all be like, We want another movie with these two, like basically immediately, like how soon can we get this? And it does seem like, you know, they had Fred Wolf do a draft and
the details. Sorry, Wilson, like the details of Fred Wolf and his screenplay for Black Sheep, like there was some type of weird contractual thing, maybe something to do with like the Writers Guild, but like he basically was given like a 2 to 4 week window to bang out a script.
There was a weird thing too, where he was like, if I didn't do it in like this amount of time, they were going to sue me. Like,
yeah.
It's like he had some sort of deal where he had to turn in another script under this, like, I think what it was that Lorne Michaels had a 2-picture deal with Paramount, and Lorne Michaels basically was like, well, they're exercising their option on this 2-picture deal to like, because they Tommy Boy did well. And I also heard that apparently, at least according to some involved with the movie, Paramount didn't do a lot of promotion of Tommy, but they were surprised by doing as well as it did. And so they were like, oh, well, this, like, according to Spade, it's like, well, Tommy Boy was very much them, like, figuring it out. And, like, even when that movie was difficult to make, it was like they were sort of left alone by the studio. And Black Sheep was the opposite, where suddenly it was like the studio was like, no, we need to script it this time, and it needs to be in this kind of shape. And Lorne Michaels, so, yeah, like, Peter Segal was booked already. He couldn't do, I don't know what he was making, but he couldn't make the follow-up. He couldn't make Black Sheep. Fred Wolf writes it, and Penelope Spheeris, obviously, as we mentioned, director of Wayne's World, she at that point in time, you know, the relevant experience would have been she'd made Wayne's World, not too long before that.
And I wonder, had she also, in the interim between Wayne's World and Black Sheep,
does Little Rascals come in between those?
And Beverly Hillbillies.
There you go. Yeah. So like she's kind of on a comedy hot streak. So like it makes sense that that they would want to nab her.
Oh, she is in it. She is absolutely in the wheelhouse of studio comedy at this point.
Yes.
Like studio comedy. And so she apparently comes on and is like, I don't like any of this. Like she basically like had Fred Wolf fired, like banned from the set, all this stuff. And Spade mentions that it's really kind of frank to where I'm just like, you want to tell us all this, man? Like it's a little, but like he's saying that he says in his book that Farley, his career took off, like he was clearly poised to be a movie star after Tommy Boy, and Chris had, I think there was something about, I don't know how the contracts worked exactly, but basically Chris had signed a 2-picture deal with Paramount or with Lorne Michaels. And Spade had only signed for Tommy Boy. And so when his contract for Black Sheep was negotiated, he suddenly was making more money than Chris Farley was, which according to him, you can imagine was a little bit awkward. But then Farley was offered the lead role in The Cable Guy. And The Cable Guy they were going to pay him $3 million to star in The Cable Guy. And according to Spade, that was way beyond what they were both, either one of them was going to make for Black Sheep, which is sort of interesting. In this day and age, I feel like most people you know, especially if you're coming off of a hit movie, it's like you're going to like clear like, you know, half a mil, a mil, like fairly easily. I mean, with inflation, I don't know. But like it is interesting to hear. It's like obviously $3 million is an insane amount of money. But like to hear the way Spade says it, he's just like, oh, it like that's like a life changing amount of money. And that was not what we were getting paid for Black Sheep. And apparently Spade more or less like, Black Sheep was only going to go if both of them approved of the script. And Farley was giving indications to Spade that like, well, you know, I think the script isn't quite there. And Spade reading between the lines was like, well, he wants to do Cable Guy. And Spade read the script and was like, I think it could work. Now, there's a lot of complicated ulterior motives in there. You know, professional jealousy, rivalry, what have you. The point is that Black Sheep sort of started on, it didn't seem to have the same creative energy, at least based on what I've read, that they all went into Tommy Boy with, which, you know, that happens. You know, you have your first flush of success where everything kind of pays off or goes well for you, and then you're like, oh, I know, you know, make a movie, and then, you know, it just the gears start grinding and ego comes into it and all that. But yeah, I don't know, guys, this movie, like, I mean, it's gonna be a lot shorter on my end because there are far fewer memorable moments for me than in Tommy Boy. Like I know that this movie, it's not hard to watch. I don't hate this movie, but watching it tonight, I was sort of expecting or hoping that, you know, my Letterboxd is full of people giving this like 3, 3.5, even 4 stars. Like people like more or less see it as like at worst, like a slightly less successful like follow-up to Tommy Boy. And watching it, especially like the two of them together, it's night and day. This one has, Black Sheep has stretches of dead air where there's just like nothing particularly funny happening, or like you can see the setup coming from a mile away, or they're like, it feels like they sort of didn't have it on the day. And again, I certainly think that, gun to my head, I would take, if I could only take one, I would take Farley over Spade. But having said that, it is weird to me that, I mean, it's very obvious that it was made by someone who was like, I guess we have to have David Spade in this movie.
Yeah. I mean, it, like watching it, I mean, there is a point where it begins to click between the two of them, But there's just like, maybe it's just such stretches where you just have Farley or you just have Spade, like together, they just don't have the opportunity to work together. And it's just, it's not, it doesn't have the banter or the back and forth that feels the same, feels as authentic. It feels like it is scripted.
Yeah. I can't think of any, I just can't think of like any moment that's like, that's as funny or like as good or real between them as like every line in their first scene together in Tommy Boy, when they're like on the, you know, like there's nothing as good as, you know, it's clip on. Are you sure? Like,
there's also something that I noticed, we'll get into it, but I noticed with the tone of this one, which is like with Tommy Boy, it's kind of like, it's funny that he's like a fat guy, but he's like part of the humor. And I feel like here it's like, he's a fat guy and he's just causing destruction because he is fat. Like he literally jumps into the water and like causes a boulder to go down a hill.
Yeah. Like whatever grace that Tommy Boy has in its setups and punchlines and humor and banter, it just, it's sorely lacking in Black Sheep, unfortunately. I do like the bit where they're playing checkers.
Yeah.
And Spade's like, oh, well, this is great. I never went checkers. Well, it's hard to lose if you never lose, if you never move your back row. And when like they're sleeping during the storm and it starts to hail, and then Spade's ribbing him, like, oh, I won the top bunk. Like, you can sort of see glimmers of that magic there.
But there's like a, there's a bit in the, when the, I wonder if this was somebody's highfalutin homage to Charlie Chaplin's The Gold Rush, where the cabin like slides down the hill with them inside it. But there's a part where it's like, there's a bit that I laughed at that, like, I, as soon as I laughed at it, I was like, God, this should have been better, or it should have been a bigger laugh, is when they go back into the cabin, when everything's all messed up. And David Spade's like, hey, look, this refrigerator is only stuck here by this plug. And then he just immediately unplugs it. and like, that's a funny setup. But then the payoff, it just slides into Farley. It knocks him. It hurts him. He has a hurt reaction. And then you move right along. And it's just like, okay, but like, I feel like there's nothing to, it's like the most basic payoff to that joke, when that's like, they're just, I mean, I'm not a comedy writer, someone else should do this, but like, you know, I'm sitting there watching and I'm like, that's a funny gag, why isn't it funnier?
The end of that, like the button of it is, he says like, I've got chocolate pudding down my pants, and then David says, I don't, you know, like, what is it then? If it's not chocolate pudding, what is it?
I guess he shat his pants, but like,
okay. Yes. Which is like, it's kind of funny, and their like expressions and deliveries are funny, but I remember even watching Black Sheep, like I rented it from Blockbuster Hollywood Video way back when, and watching it. And even then, at like, you know, the age where all of this stuff is gold, I remember even then thinking like, oh, this just isn't quite as good as Tommy Boy. I remember that joke specifically and being like, that feels like a joke that me and my friends would try to write. And like, it feels just kind of like sweaty and obvious. And like the punchline is like that Farley pooped his pants, I guess, but it just doesn't quite work. And again, like, I don't want to repeat what I said earlier, but I feel like it kicks into like a much more confident energy when he's at that concert. It almost feels like a different movie, and maybe that's could be Spheeris just being more in her element, just filming Farley at like a rock show. And by all accounts, like, she dug Farley and they got along fine, and she respected and appreciated his talent. And you can feel that there, but just all the stuff like in the cabin kind of works because it's them together, and them together is going to be some sort of gold, but maybe it's just not the type of comedy that she excels at. Maybe it's just the fact that she wasn't really feeling the material. It could have been just, you know, it sounds like there's any number of X factors that made Tommy Boy work. And it sounds like there's any number of X factors that worked against Black Sheep, unfortunately. I said earlier about like how, when I was younger, I kind of like, oh, maybe we're grading Tommy Boy on a curve. But like now in the decades, it's like, no, like Tommy Boy is great. And it just works beautifully. Black Sheep, I think, is more of a case of kind of grading it on a curve. And we miss Farley, and we love him and Spade together. I feel like time has been kind to it in a way. Like I watch Black Sheep now and I have a good, like a good hang with it, but I definitely see it as like a pretty undeniable lesser B-side to Tommy Boy. But you know, like it's hard to hate because it is overall like a fun hang of a movie, and you know, it's in and out in like 85 minutes.
Yeah, I think the thing that I just, when I think about Black Sheep, it feels like, and this especially comes through in Farley's performance, flop sweat. It just feels like everyone involved is sort of desperate. It feels like everyone is just like, God, if we, like, is this working? Like, please tell me this is working. And there's none of the, like Tommy Boy doesn't have that, like, sort of desperation to it, where it's like, that movie just feels like it knows what it's doing in its own modest, sort of sweet way.
With Black Sheep, you can sort of see glimmers of attempts at capturing that sweetness. Like some of the stuff with Farley and his brother, who's played by Tim Matheson.
Yeah.
Some stuff with Farley, like in the rec center with like playing football with the kids and like bonding with like the new kid. Like you can sort of see that sweetness there and that sort of just once in a generation charm that he had kind of come out in the movie. But the movie doesn't really follow up on those moments. It doesn't really hang together in the way that Tommy Boy does, unfortunately. I think, in a weird way, it helps to watch Black Sheep if you have some context for like its sort of rocky production. Like that helps sort of, to me at least, that kind of helps me watch it with a forgiving eye. Like, oh well, like yeah, like this thing was kind of a mess, so I'm glad that we got something halfway decent out of it, sort of.
Do you think one thing I like watching this? So like you have the Animal House call out between having Tim Matheson and the other guy from Animal House, who is the assistant to the other, to the woman running, the woman that
is. Bruce McGill.
Bruce McGill. Yeah. So you have that. Do you think this is also a reference to his other idol of John? Was John Candy an idol of his?
Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. So do you think like the outdoors is kind of like the great outdoors?
That's interesting.
Been so long since I've seen it, but it like to me that always kind of like I definitely see the Gold Rush reference, but there's a part of it that just feels like great outdoors. I mean, I just think being out in the camping scenario.
I think that's an interesting idea. But thinking of Candy real quick, I recently, I don't know if you guys have had these nights when maybe you're feeling a little low or weird and you maybe rewatch not just a movie, but maybe just like a scene from a movie that can kind of lift you up. And anyways, I was having a week and a half ago, just having like a lone evening. And I just rewatched, of all things, the last 10 minutes of Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. that very kind of devastating and uplifting emotional climax of that movie. And Candy in that movie, if Farley had lived longer, I could see him playing a role like that. Very much so, where he's sort of, you know, the jovial, boisterous cannonball, but being able to exercise some of those more emotional beats to a Spade-esque character or whatever. I'm actually going down a road that we only need to really go into until our next episode, but the Belushi comparisons are kind of obvious, but I think the Candy comparisons are more apt if you think about what Farley's career could have been had he not died young.
I just have to briefly, I've had my world rot to fucking pieces realizing that is Bruce McGill in Animal House.
Yeah.
I've never realized this because for years I've been like, every time Bruce McGill shows up in a movie, I'm like, I love this guy. Like, it's so cool. See, I've seen Animal House 10 times in my life. I have not one single time put two and two together that guy is Bruce McGill. Holy shit.
You don't think it's not a Bruce McGill character or like in the way we think of Bruce McGill, it's like, oh, well, that's like the insider lawyer or like, you know, like the dude who shows up in like fucking Cinderella Man, who kind of like has like that homespun charm.
He's the he's Nicolas Cage's Mark in Matchstick Man, like the guy who he conned.
Yes. Yes.
God almighty. That's amazing. I'm so happy that I now realize that you were like, Austin, you just were like, well, yeah, you get Tim Addison, you get Bruce McGill. And I was like, Bruce McGill wasn't in Animal House? Like, idiot. And then I just Googled it and I was just like, whoa, that's amazing. Not just in it, but like, I mean, like prominent. Like that's a role that everyone remembers. Anyhow, nice seeing Bruce McGill in this movie. Christine Ebersole recently had a delightful cameo appearance in Licorice Pizza playing Lucille Ball.
Oh, that's right. Oh, shit. You know, like from this era, I think of her as Richie Rich's mom.
Yeah. Whoa. Fuck. Damn. It's all coming back to me now.
I mean, so like, that's a thing, like to get positive, Black Sheep does have a great cast to it. And some of, you know, and they all have their moments. Like Gary Busey's having a great time, which is always fun to watch.
he gets my favorite line reading in the whole movie, where she, like, he's up on stage with her at the end and she tries to say something and he goes, I don't remember if this is the exact line, but it's something like this. He goes, silence, witch. Like, and it just keeps going.
That's great.
Yeah, Gary Busey is legitimate, very, very funny in this movie. And you know, he's just sort of leaning into like Gary Busey's fucking crazy and insane. And I like his, the art design of his like bus out in the woods. It's like surrounded by landmines.
I like how we see Grant Heslov, like in his pre, I guess, Clooney collaborator days, just being like the friendly cop.
So it's pre being Clooney's producer, but post getting killed by gorillas in Congo. So on the Grant Heslov timeline, that's where we're at.
And also post, I think, or maybe this would have been around the same time, being like the sidekick to Schwarzenegger and Tom Arnold in True Lies.
I think it would have been the same year.
Good year.
Yeah. Yeah. That's very funny. Yeah, every time I see Grant Heslov, it's like, it's weird because he does have a distinctive enough face to where I'm just like, oh yeah, it's that guy who like is an actor. Oh yeah, he was the he's like the comic relief, the Rob Schneider type character in The Scorpion King.
Is he? Wow.
Yes. Anyways, weird career that man has had. Yeah. He's an Oscar winner for being a producer of Argo, so good for him. Yeah, I don't know. The plot, who gives a shit? The plot is just that Chris Farley's character, his older brother, Tim Matheson, is running for governor of Washington?
It's Washington because of Seattle, yeah.
So he's running for governor of Washington or whatever. And he wants to help. Chris Farley wants to help, but he's just bumbling and dumb. And he drives the van at the beginning. I thought it was kind of funny where he's like, the dogs are chasing him. And
the dogs are the dog bit's great. It's like, what is with you dogs? You think this van's in heat? Like, there's lots of Farley-isms in this movie that are just kind of like sprinkled throughout, like that maybe were written, but or more likely just kind of off the cuff. When you get into the Chris Farley Show oral biography, you know, there's lots of bits where they talk about like, oh, that line, that gesture, that whatever, that's just pure Chris. Like that wasn't written the Midwesternness of him, I think, is sometimes like an underrated or overlooked part of his whole personality. And so like just little bits where he's like, good Lord, or you know, like jeepers, like, you know, like for as crude and lewd as he could be on and off camera, like there's that sort of just, you know, kind of small town, like Midwestern thing that comes out. But again, just sort of speaking to kind of like the weird sloppy stakes of this movie. Like, yeah, so like Tim Matheson's running for governor, you know, handsome, charming Tim Matheson, and Farley kind of like ruins this local rally by crashing his van into a marquee. And like Matheson is like kind of like annoyed, but just sort of laughing about it. And then it cuts to the scene that's clearly like was like shot, but then like just dubbed in like post ADR, because like it's like this very like long shot of Farley and Matheson on a football field, like having a heart to heart. There's no close up of them. It's just like it's just like you hear like audio of being like, oh, I'm real sorry about that brother. Like, oh, it's okay. Don't worry about it. He just kind of like ruined, like, and it's a series of fuck ups that Matheson sort of like, oh, he's my brother. We just need to find something constructive for him to do. And then later on in the movie, there's one bit like after the concert and Kill Whitey, where he's like, just stay out of the way, damn it. Like, oh, like he, you know, there's that kind of like brotherly anger moment, but you know, a lot of that stuff feels very just kind of half-hearted in the movie.
Well, that feels, you're right, because I think that's a great example of like where it's clearly like a dynamic that they sort of wanted to repeat from Tommy Boy, where it's right. Like, you know, you have like, you know, the audience is gonna like Chris, and so you don't want to like make the brother isn't an antagonist, and so like you can't have him be like super, and like there's a part of me watching it, like while I was watching it, there's a part of me that kind of appreciated that they didn't go the even more obvious route of just having the brother be like
a dick.
Be a dick and career obsessed. And like, there's no bullshit moment where the brother has to like realize at a certain point, like, no, that's my brother. And like, I, you know, it's like, he always cares about him. He's like a decent human being. But also I kind of respect that decision, but it also undercuts the stakes of the movie, like what you're saying, because where it's like emotionally and just plot wise, when it's like, oh, I screwed that up. Well, don't worry about it. It's like, that's a crazy thing to say. Like, you clearly like don't have what it takes to win higher office, because.
And we don't have any like real, do we have any real proof of like that Christine Ebersole is terrible? I mean, she has
faking votes, like,
yeah, that itself, but, and I guess she's also along the way conning people to be,
yeah, she's just shown to be like ruthless, I guess. Yeah. I mean, like, if you're comparing her as like the heavy of the movie to Aykroyd, I think she's painted in a more like evil light than Aykroyd, who's just sort of seen as just kind of like a little oily and slick, but ultimately is never like cruel to Tommy. He's like, oh, you tried your best. I respect that. But and now it's time to let like the big boys play. Like, he's a little condescending, but he's not a total dick to Tommy.
Yeah.
Ebersole is a bit more witchy, but even then, like, it's not, you know, she's not like, you know, burying bodies anywhere. She's just, you know, kind of pumping up boats in these very small towns.
Yeah. I mean, there's just no like stakes. If like he loses, it's just she continues, and there's some promises that she didn't keep from her previous campaign. It's not right. Like,
and then the way that again, it maybe I just know too much about behind the scenes, but just it feels like apathy bordering on contempt on the part of Penelope Spheeris, which I don't. Again, I love her as a director. I'm not trying to like throw shade at her. Like, if she had very good reason to hate David Spade. But like the way that Spade is introduced in this movie, it yes. is so tossed off. It's literally just like, oh, he's in the front seat of the limo and he hears them talking about how they need someone to basically babysit. And he's just like, well, will you give me a staff position if I do that? And they're like, sure. And then that's it. That's all we get like for that. And it's just like, and that's all of Spade's motivation. It's, yeah, and like I said, like the movie does just like a fairly half-assed job of like even putting Farley and Spade in scenes together and like letting them bounce off one another.
And again, like if you compare it to Tommy Boy, there's an arc and a progression to Richard and Tommy and their growing friendship and Richard's growing like respect for Tommy and realizing how to like be in his corner and how to help him find his inner salesman and all that. With Farley and Spade and Black Sheep, I'm blanking on their characters' names now because that's what we're dealing with. But like Spade is, you know, kind of there for like cynical reasons. Like he wants to, you know, just do like just babysit him, like kind of like prove himself just to get a staff position. And so when they're first together, he's kind of doing his Spade shtick with Farley and kind of just like, you know, putting him down. And But like, there's an early scene where, I guess just because of like bad PR, Farley is fired from his beloved rec center job. And it's like a tender moment between Spade and Farley. And like Spade is being genuine and like, I don't know what to say, buddy. Like, that's awful. It's terrible. I'm so sorry. And then like the next bit is them is like, you know, back to like ribbing Farley and calling him a moron. And it's very, you know, rocky and like the progression of what their friendship is supposed to be and stuff. And again, like maybe I'm asking too much of Black Sheep, but again, like if you're going to do the comparison to Tommy Boy, which you can't talk about either of those movies without the other one, they just are a pair. You know, it definitely suffers in comparison.
Yeah.
Again, just that whole sort of slapdash thrown together quality of Black Sheep. Sorry, Austin.
Oh, no. There's a feeling of this to me when watching them and just, you know, really being involved in knowing as much as I know about Tommy Boy and then rewatching Black Sheep. There's something about it that feels like a save as quality. Like the script was like a save as where there's just pieces of it that I feel like they are not the same, but they follow similar trajectories and like similar incidents happen and similar jokes kind of happen throughout that they just feel, I don't know. It feels to me like a rush job, which it sounds like it was.
Yes.
In this, he basically commits, Chris Farley commits a lot of crimes to get his brother finally the moment to like win the governorship. just like in Tommy Boy, where he's got to commit a few crimes along the way. And I mean, trade out the road trip for the cabin and like the voting walking piece. Like there's pieces of it. And the way the movie starts and ends and the brother is basically, there's just so much to me that like, they seem like similarities in a way that it just feels like this is the lesser of, I mean, it's obviously the lesser of the two. But this feels like the lesser of like a remake of Tommy Boy.
Yeah. Like obviously Tommy Boy does not lack at all for physical comedy and pratfalls, mm-hmm. but like, you know, like there's like the running joke of Tommy always hitting his head like, oh, that's going to leave a mark. And like, there's lots of similar pratfalls and, you know, slapstick moments in Black Sheep, but like, you know, Tommy bonking his head and moments in Tommy Boy, they're coming at the middle of or at the end of scenes when like something has happened to progress the plot, like a sale has failed or a sale has succeeded. They're on their way to Zelensky's office in Chicago. Like the movie has forward momentum. And Black Sheep, it's like, yeah, they're canvassing votes like in that small sort of like, you know, like woodsy area. And it's just like, there's snakes in like the well bucket. And then they're going to run away from the snakes. And then Spade runs into some deliverance looking, you know, like kids, and they spray him with a fire hydrant. And then they're running away from those kids and Farley bangs into a tree. Like, it's all just very like I'm not knocking the physical humor. I'm just knocking in the, again, like sort of the flop sweaty energy of it. We're just like, oh, it's Farley. Let's make sure he hits something. Sometimes it works. Like I do genuinely enjoy the falling down the like hill gag, which, you know, like I took a video of it and sent it to you guys. So like the whole thing runs just like over a minute. So you're kind of getting into like that sideshow Bob Rake territory where like it goes long, so long of him rolling down the hill where it's like stops being funny. Then it becomes funny again. And like, there's like little beats in between where like he's able to grab onto like some plants, like, oh, stay strong, little roots. And, you know, and eventually falls all the way down. And he has that great delivery of like, what the hell was that all about? Like, yeah. It's a good bit. And I think, you know, I wonder if our similar in the SNL comedy family guys who did Hot Rod might have seen that bit as an inspiration for their even more epic and gloriously composed epic fall down a hill that Sandberg does in Hot Rod. Like there are several bits in this movie that I think work well, but they just lack that cohesion, I suppose, of Tommy Boy. And again, maybe I'm asking for too much, but when you put them side by side, you can see the difference. You can feel it.
None of it seems to be particular. Not very much of it seems to be particularly inspired in any way. The one scene that I would say rose to that, not the only time I laughed, because there are a couple of easy laughs here and there. I mean, there are a bunch of funny people involved in this movie, but the scene, and there's no Spade involved, but the scene where Harley gets stoned with the black musicians.
Yes.
And that's a scene that feels like it could just like just be in a movie today with like very little like change, where he's just like, so you're telling me that this whole thing is a racist patriarchy? Like, he's going on and on. Like, they're just telling him about how like the deck is stacked against like non-white people and like all this stuff. And he's just like, that sucks. Like, I'm gonna go have a word with somebody. And they're like, yeah, some people. You go whitey, like out. Whatever. It's just like him, like just particularly like particularly the fact that he's like he's basically saying, I'm gonna go speak to the manager about this. Like,
yeah,
is very funny. I don't know. That's basically all I got for Black Sheep, guys. Like, it's not. It's, yeah. It's fine. I'm not upset that I watched it. If they released, if they released a Blu-ray double set with Tommy Boy and Black Sheep, you know, as long as it was reasonably priced, I wouldn't be upset to own Black Sheep. But it's not anything. It, you know, gun to my head, I would just watch Tommy Boy twice in a row rather than watch Tommy Boy Black Sheep again. So I don't know. That's sort of, it made sense to, it definitely, I'm glad we did it like this. I'm glad it would have sucked if we just done Tommy Boy and then done another episode where it's like, oh, we also have to talk about Black Sheep. It's basically the same thing, but not as good.
Yeah, yeah.
It makes sense as an addendum to this.
Maybe like the briefest like summation that I can make is like, when I watch Tommy Boy, I'm watching a movie that I love. When I watch Black Sheep, I put it on for pleasant background noise when I'm having like a Farley week.
Mm-hmm.
I'm having a pleasant hang with Farley and Spade again, but I'm not engaged with it the same way I am as I am with Tommy Boy, which is like a beloved, you know, classic now for a reason. I don't hate it. It's too slight to hate.
Right.
It's not a disaster, but again, like when you put them side by side, you see how Sheep suffers in comparison, but you know, it's still a pleasant 80 minutes with Farley and Spade. And you could do worse by that.
And Gary Busey. I don't know. Austin, what are your final thoughts on Black Sheep?
And I will say, as much as I did watch Tommy Boy as a kid, I also would watch this too. So I have like some nostalgia for it, but generally watching it now, you can see the faults of it and just see how it's not as strong. I think for me, a little bit of the political stuff like feels a little bit relevant today as it probably did then. So that's probably the most I like took away out of it on this rewatch, which I probably last watched it in the early 2000s. So it's been a little bit, but yeah, I think I can agree with Chris. What Chris said was, could watch it basically in the background, but I'm not going to just seek it out again.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And you know, it makes sense, I think, for several reasons why we would talk about these two together, coming in such close succession. The Farley Spade of it all, and also too, just the fact that like, when we talk about Farley and his movies, these are the two that people remember. These are the people, these are the two that people still talk about and watch. Our next episode, which will focus on Beverly Hills Ninja and Almost Heroes, are rarely talked about and often kind of dismissed as the beginning of like the sad downturn of Farley's movie career / personal problems kind of becoming more toxic, literally, for him. Having said that, I am stoked to talk about those movies next episode, because I think they do have value and I think they are better, especially Almost Heroes, which I have a very, very sweet soft spot for. I think they are worth the time and better than their reputations would suggest, and have some great Farley moments. And with Beverly Hills Ninja, which really gets into like this, like the sweet side of him, I think, you know, basically we have four starring roles with Farley that we have to work with. And I think that has value in of itself to kind of think of, to like appreciate what he left us and to ponder what could have been as well. I just realized I kind of stepped on your toes there, Wilson, leading us into the next episode. I'm sorry.
Oh no, that's, I mean, you nailed it. That's basically, so what, yeah. So basically, like you said, we covered, you know, his first two starring gigs, and yeah, I mean, it does feel, you know, we're not trying to give any of these movies the shaft or anything. It is just the case that, you know, Black Sheep's a weird little edge case where it makes more sense to talk about with Tommy Boy, and Beverly Hills Ninja and Almost Heroes. I mean, Almost Heroes was not even released until about 6 months after Farley had died. Yeah. And so it's like, and we'll get into that next episode. But yeah, sadly, his movie career was cut tragically short. And it was important for us to, before we embark on, obviously we get to touch on Spade, who will, you know, continue to be, we'll cover him in more detail later on. But before we jumped into Happy Madison proper, like the actual with Deuce Bigelow, the birth of Happy Madison, it obviously for you know, if you've been listening to this podcast, if you know any of the people we talk about, you know, Farley looms over a lot of this stuff, and he you know has sort of an outsized figure in the early Sandler days, and yeah, these two movies coming where they do, where, you know, literally Sandler's one and two movies, this movie and Farley's one and two movies are released like weeks apart from one another, my understanding. Like Black Sheep was released a couple of weeks before Happy Gilmore was.
And what, so, a time.
And boy, if you like Chris Farley, do not read Siskel and Ebert's, don't watch Siskel and Ebert's take on Black Sheep, because they are incredibly mean and ruthless, and Siskel is talking about how much he hates Chris Farley and like thinks he's like awful. And then it literally is a few weeks later when they review Happy Gilmore, which they apparently hated even worse. Chris Farley is referenced, and Roger Ebert contradicts himself and like defends Chris Farley and is like, well, like, you know, like I think Chris Farley could be good in a movie if he was given the right role. But yeah, anyways, just these movies coming out so close to, like, you know, like we're watching the what we now know is the beginning of Sandler's very long story career, and you know, obviously Happy Gilmore is much closer to the quality of like it's a much way better movie than Black Sheep is. Happy Gilmore succeeds pretty much entirely, but it is very interesting to see that they were like moving in similar, like, increments, you know, including, you know, they both hooked up with Dennis Dugan. Well, Happy Gilmore was Dennis Dugan, so, but Beverly Hills Ninja, Dennis Dugan.
Almost Heroes is Christopher Guest, which...
Christopher Guest, yeah.
I honestly feel like there's so much fascinating things to talk about Almost Heroes. It's a Christopher Guest movie that's not a mockumentary. It's a period piece comedy, and, yeah, like, it's... That is a movie that, over the years, has received very little attention or critical love, and you know, I don't want to oversell it or state it, a good chunk of my affection is the age in which I watched it, but I think there's more there than people give it credit for, and there are some A+ classic Farley moments. Also, just on a quick personal note, I owned, you know, at the age of what, 11 or 12, late 90s, I owned both Dirty Work and Almost Heroes on VHS. And I remember, you know, when I would watch them over and over, the VHS for Dirty Work, the opening like trailer reel had a trailer for Almost Heroes. And on the VHS for Almost Heroes, the opening trailer reel had one for Dirty Work. So they've always been kind of connected in my mind.
Nice.
And of course, Farley shows up memorably in Dirty Work as well. So, you know, my kind of like, oh, people are sleeping on this. This is actually kind of like weirdly brilliant. If you go into it with the right attitude, like the way I feel about Dirty Work, and we all do, is I have, to a lesser degree, but still very passionate affection for Almost Heroes. So I'm super stoked to talk about those, because I feel like they have value.
Yeah, Almost Heroes is, I'm excited to see it. I've never actually seen it. I feel like it's one that's kind of buried and hard to find. Definitely not as easy to find as Tommy Boy or Black Sheep. Beverly Hills Ninja, a little bit easier to find.
I was reading about Almost Heroes before we started recording tonight, and it was very funny. I just read a quick snippet where it was like, oh, they put a lot of money into the production design because they thought that they figured that the comedy, like, you want to make it as real and give it as much verisimilitude as possible, so that, you know, and then, like, what's going to be funny is the ridiculous stuff happening within this very well-realized world. And I'm like, that sounds to me like the right approach, but it also sounds like the way to burn money just to the ground. Like, it's just like, yeah, oh, like, what's a good way to throw money into a furnace is just like, well, hey, let's go all out on make. I don't know. It's completely different, but it's like the Will Ferrell movie Land of the Lost, where it's like, oh, this we spent $150 million making an incredibly faithful recreation of the show that no one gives a shit about. So, like,
well, I mean, as someone who knows Almost Heroes quite well, I'm kind of just like running it through my head right now. I mean, like, there are some beautiful shots of, like, natural beauty and, like, the wilderness as they move west, but, like, that movie does not look expensive. So
okay. So maybe that's the more important thing, is that they fucking fail.
I guess so. Like, I don't know. There's a lot to talk about there.
Yeah, looking forward to it. All right, so I think anyone have any other closing thoughts?
I think we've covered most of it, and there's more to, you know, dive into next episode, and I'm sure we'll have, you know, moments to kind of like really just talk about Farley's legacy and career. But I'll just repeat what I said at the jump. Like, I've been looking forward to us doing this for a real long time. I'm so glad that we are. You know, he's such an important guy, not just in the context of Sandler's career and the Happy Madison, you know, family, but I think he's just, you know, there's a reason why people like us are still talking about Farley, still watching his movies, and still speaking of him with reverence and affection. There's a reason why that Sandler song and tribute hit so many people hard the way it did. You know, it's so sad that we only have these four starring roles, but I'm glad we get to talk about them and enjoy them, and not just his movies, but, you know, his whole body of work, SNL, and like little bits and cameos he did. Like, you know, again, speaking to Penelope Spheres, Farley has that great cameo in the first Wayne's World as like the security guard bouncer who gives them the very important context for how to find like the studio guy. Farley just fills me with so much joy. Like his energy, his sweetness, you know, you read a lot about his personal life and there's some dark avenues there. You know, he was a guy with his demons, but he was also, by all accounts, a very sweet and sincere person, sincere in his friendship, sincere in his faith, sincere in his charity work, and like community service outreach, which was both a part of his like recovery, as well as just a part of his nature. There's some sections in the Chris Farley autobiography, the oral history, where, you know, like SNL buddies and like comedy buddies were hearing all these stories about the community outreach that he did, like at his funeral. They're like, oh, like I was one of his, like, I thought I was his best friend or one of his best friends. I had no idea he was doing this. So like, he did a lot of that stuff, but like privately, just for its own sake. So I don't know, like, just the more time I spend with this guy's movies, the more time I learn about him, the just more affection I feel for him, as a person, as a performer, as an icon. So I'm glad we're doing this.
Yeah. What about you, Austin?
Yeah. I mean, I think given this short filmography that he's in, but given the rich amount of stuff otherwise out there that we know him from, I'm excited to get into this and talk about him because he was always a favorite. And he's easy to love. Don't know how you can hate him. So screw you, Ebert and Siskel. Less Ebert.
Well, we haven't seen Beverly Hills Ninja yet, so we'll see. We'll see if we can find hate in our heart for. I'm kidding. That's not going to happen. So yeah, I'm super stoked. I was thrilled to revisit Tommy Boy. You know, talking about Black Sheep. Just want to talk about the friends, I guess. I think it's actually, especially like reading the passages about this in Spade's autobiography, I'm curious to see now, hearing him talk about his performances with Farley specifically, I'll be curious. And again, it won't be for a little bit because we have some other ground to cover before we get to Spade. But when we get into Spade's like solo work, I'm kind of curious to like, it'll be very interesting seeing like how his energy is different, like how it gets tempered a little bit by Farley or softened a little bit in a way that like, I mean, obviously, as we've said in Tommy Boy, like, I think he's like just right. It, you know, he's like that. He's exactly as much snark or smarm as you need in something like Tommy Boy. And so I'll be curious to revisit some of the Spade movies too, to see how like, well, you know, just being away from, was what he did he does he need to be with like a Farley, like that sort of moderating influence, which is odd to think of Chris Farley as in any way a moderating influence in any way, but what can you do? All right, well, this has been a great episode as always. Really enjoyed talking with y'all, always do. So yeah, please, thank you for listening. We truly, truly appreciate it. Y'all, everyone stay safe and healthy out there. Be sure and, you know, tell your friends about the podcast, like us, review us on iTunes if you feel like it, or wherever you get your podcast. And be sure to tune in next time for our episode where we will close out the Farley side of things with Beverly Hills Ninja and Almost Heroes. And we'll, you know, we'll do a little more cleanup. We'll probably talk about some, maybe we'll talk about his cameo in Coneheads. Who's to say? I guess without further ado, I am Wilson Smith.
This is Chris Giles.
And Austin Culp.
And we'll see you next time on the Billy Gilmore Podcast.